Great. Thank you so much, Chen Chao, and thank you for the opportunity to present our findings on this paper. This paper was done with Corinne Cortez. I can see Corinne's here now, and Lee Mormon, both my colleagues at the University of Wollongong. So I'll give you a little bit of background on IFRA 6, or in particular, how we came about to complete this project. So in 2018, sometime in September 2018, DISB announced a recommencement of the extractive industries project with the view to deciding on whether to revise or replace IFRA 6. And so where we came in is as part of the project, the ISB obtained information from national standard setters in Australia, Canada, Norway, and South Africa. And these parties had contributed to the reassessment of IFRA 6 in 2010. So we completed this project as part for the AASB as input to the consultative process on the current project. So what was the ISB interested in? The ISB was interested in significant changes that had occurred in the extractive industry sector between 2010 and 2018, essentially, in terms of accounting policies, financial reporting issues, scope of the industry, any regulatory requirements that had changed in that time, and any changes in the classification systems with respect to resource and reserves. So just to give you a quick background on AASB 6, I know in this setting this is probably not necessary, but I'll just quickly go through the differences between IFRA 6 and AASB 6. So AASB 6 is largely consistent with IFRA 6, except for the addition of some Australia-specific paragraphs, and this relate to the measurement and recognition of the E&E expenditures, the exploration and evaluation expenditures. So while IFRA 6 allows companies to adopt their treatment of choice, AASB 6 narrows this treatment by specifying an area of interest for Australian companies. So what is this area of interest method? It refers to an area, it can be a geographical area, where the presence of minerals, mineral deposits, or an oil and gas field is favourable or has been proven to exist. And Australian companies also have to define what an area of interest is under AASB 6. So we did this project in three phases. They're interrelated, but the most important part of the project is phase three, where we interviewed industry stakeholders to obtain their views on the questions posed by IASB about significant changes that have occurred between 2010 and 2018. But I'll go through each of the phases in turn so you get an idea of what we did. So phase one was a survey of disclosure practices of 98 Australian companies listed on the Australian Stock Exchange, the ASX. Now, these 98 companies covered the energy sector and the materials sector, and they range from IPOs to large cap companies. The reason we surveyed the disclosure practices of these companies was to get an idea of how the standard was being applied in practice and whether there were any impediments to application of the standard. In phase two, we looked at any significant changes that had occurred between 2010 and 2017 in this case for a sub-sample of 36 companies. In order to identify any regulatory changes that had occurred in that time and any industry relevant changes. In phase three, interviews were conducted with industry stakeholders. In total, 12 interviews were conducted, and we interviewed preparers of financial statements, 8 preparers of financial statements, comprising 2 junior explorers and 6 large and 6 from large companies, 2 regulators and 2 accountants from Big 4 firms. These interviews took between 45 minutes and an hour each, and we asked them the questions stated earlier. So this slide shows our findings from phase one. So on the left-hand side of the slide, we report on the accounting method chosen by these 98 Australian companies in accounting for their E&E assets. So if I take you to the last bar in blue, this shows for the full sample, 80% of the firms had chosen the area of interest method in accounting for their E&E assets. Another 9% of companies accounted for this under the expense and reinstate. And in the light blue at the top, about 7% of companies chose the successful efforts method. When we split the sample by size, going from the IPO to large cap companies, you can see that the trend in choice is consistent among the different size companies. And on the right-hand side of the slide, we show you how the area of interest is defined by these companies. This is figure 4 in the paper. So we've divided the companies into the 2 sectors, into the material sector and the energy sector. So the material sector in blue and the energy sector in orange. So 50% of the companies in the material sector define AOI under rights to tenure. And another 30% reported under legal rights to explore. Within the energy sector, they were divided between rights to tenure and geographical area. And to a lesser extent, about 25% of the firms reported under legal rights to explore. So you can see here that there's some variability in the definition of area of interest. It is at this point I'll also talk about some of the results from phase two, although I won't go through them in this presentation. But what we found was that this definition of an area of interest had improved over time. That is, there were fewer firms who had undisclosed definition for area of interest, and for fewer firms for which the AOI definition is unclear. So we see that as an improvement in the disclosure over time. Now I'll go on to talk to you about some of the our findings from the interviews, which as I said is we think is the main part of this study. So of course we asked our interviewees the question, do you think we need a standard for the extractive industries? And the answer to that question was an overwhelming yes. Yes, we still need a standard, an extractive industry standard, because of the unique characteristics of this sector. It's high risk return model, and it's hybrid of tangible and intangible assets. However, they believe that while the standard was important, it was in need of revisiting, especially in the area of guidance. So essentially, our interviewees felt that there was a lack of guidance in the current standard. Okay, I'm going to show you some excerpts from the interviews. So one interview we said there was not much has changed from a standard setting perspective since 2010. There's still a lack of clarity as to what accounting would be. And another one said that they had to borrow from other standards because an issue is not spelled out clearly in AASB 6. So this lack of guidance leads to impediments in practice and also in the interpretation of the accounting reports. So one interviewee said that if you don't have a good knowledge of the accounting choices the preparers are making, then you wouldn't realize what people that can actually do whatever they want. So the lack of guidance, I guess, suggests flexibility in interpretation of the standard. Other implications of this limited guidance was the significant flexibility, where some preparers felt that they can build up an argument anywhere to keep an expense on the books and it will support their interpretation of this area. So this suggests variability in interpretation and so in the reporting of these numbers. The interviewees also talked about reliance on external guidance. Because the guidance wasn't coming from the standard, they were looking elsewhere, such as the IFRS publications, and to accounting firms, and to peers in the industry. So they said that while the flexibility is good, they couldn't get the answers. They were struggling to get the answers they needed. In some cases, that they had to look elsewhere for the answers. So because this was an Australian sample, we asked them the question of how AASB 6 compares to IFRS 6. So our interviewee said that despite the flexibility permitted under IFRS 6, they preferred AASB 6. They saw it as an improvement because of the Australian specific sections. They said the move to IFRS 6 was seen as a positive move to standardise practice in the industry, resulting in less cowboys out there. They said it was the AASB 6 was far superior to IFRS 6. And they said that the area of interest was a good starting point. It made sense and it gave more clarity than the international version. So that was a thumbs up to AASB 6 in restricting the choice here. Remember, we were asking the preparers of the financial statements about the changes that had occurred since 2010. So they reported on amendments to standards that have affected the extractive industry's reporting. So some of the standards, some of the changes mentioned were the changes to leasing, revenue recognition, and also the definition of assets and liabilities. Many also talked about the increase in obligations in terms of closure and rehabilitation that were becoming more and more critical in this sector. But they were saying there was not a huge amount of guidance on what to do in terms of accounting for these increased obligations. So you see here, our interviewers talked about that interaction between the leasing standard and also these closure and rehabilitation obligations, where they mentioned that there was an issue around closure and rehabilitation obligation when it's part tangible asset or part lease asset. The preparers also talk about relying on industry resources in determining the resource assessment. And they relied on the JORC code for the mining industry and the PRIMS guidelines for the oil and gas industry. They use these resources to provide guidance on definition clarification and estimation of the reserves. They felt that this was really important to determine the production profile and useful life of assets, to understand company value, and also the impairment of cash generating units. One interviewee went so far as to say that because the joke statement was prepared by a competent person, it carried the gravitas of an audit report. Of course, our interviewees talked a lot about climate change, the impact of climate change on the sector. They talked about the increasing environmental obligations, which changed the profile of the sector, and the focus on sustainability, which led to an increase in the number of contracts and which embedded financial penalties and termination clauses for non-performance or breaches of environmental performance. So in a way, these environmental obligations with the focus on sustainability has really changed the disclosures that the sector is required to make. So they talked about the accounting treatment for carbon offsets, the determination of impairment, and the discounting that's going on as a result of climate changes. They made mention of the thermal coal industry that is receiving a lot of pressure from financing, from shareholders, and from insurers as well. And they said that, you know, life has got a whole lot more difficult for these guys in the sector. Other changes that have occurred in this industry is in terms of more innovative financing and changes to commodities as a result of technological developments. So the interviewees talk about the streaming arrangements and how those arrangements and contracts were extremely complex and difficult to account for within the accounting standards. They also talked about new commodities that have come about because of technological developments in extraction, such as coal seam gas. So they were trying to get their heads around how to account for this new thing, and how to recognize the impairment of this asset. Okay, so I'll now summarize the findings from the interviews. Yes, the interviewers reported significant changes to accounting policies and reporting issues between 2010 and 2018 in terms of impairment of the E&E assets, the closure obligations, and also the new leasing standard. They said there were changes in activities, the emergence of new industries as a result of new technologies and expanded nature of deposits, scope of deposits. They talked about the reliance on JORC. However, while they were arguing, while they used it in measurement, they wondered whether it should be extended to company valuation. And lastly, they also mentioned the changes in the regulatory environment around the uncertainty from the climate change impact. And one of the other effects of this climate change impact is the hardening of the credit market for the coal industry, leading to alternative financing, one of the ones mentioned was the streaming arrangements. So what recommendations have we come to from the findings? The recommendation here is for to proceed with the standard, to keep the standard, but to revise it to enhance the disclosure requirements, because the preparers in this industry recognize that the flexibility really impedes the comparability, and such lack of comparability leads to less decision useful information for investors. In particular, they sought additional guidance on the expense versus capitalization, impairment already mentioned before, how to account for the new financing arrangements, and also the merging of the mining practices. So in summary, keep IFRS 6, but provide more guidance. Thank you.
Thanks, Millicent, for your excellent presentation. I think your paper and the presentation actually covered a lot, not only about the units of account, impairment, accounting, etc., but also covered about, you know, climate change and sustainability, because it's really a hot topic at this moment. So I think we really appreciate your research and your team. So now I think we also got two excellent, you know, discussants. One is Victoria Cloud from the University of New South Wales, and also Tom Scott from my fellow board member of ISB. So now first, let's go to Victoria.
So first off, my first comment is going to be on the title. I would say sneak in extractive industries in after the AASB 6. You want to grab people straight away with your title, and so then they'll go, oh yes, because it's not a standard people kind of have as a daily kind of conversation. It's like IFRS 15, you know, we're all going, oh, what's happening? That affects us very regularly, revenue recognition. So just, yeah, sneak in extractive industries there. So I think first off, looking at the research question, motivation puzzle, I think in the paper, it would be a benefit to kind of go, this is what our research question is. And I've kind of framed it for you as, is it, you know, like, what is this? What are the current practices in reporting? And what are the perceptions? Because you're kind of picking up on those two aspects. And that will then give the reader an in, because I think the fit for purpose is very standard setter kind of framing. So maybe framing it more, what's happening, and then what are the perceptions? So this accounting standard was supposed to be an interim standard. It's now not being revisited until 2018. So it's timely of what's happening. It's been a long time with an interim standard in place. So it's good to be examining at this point, and very useful for IASB's information of fit for purpose. Also, it's part of this puzzle of that extractive industries is a significant global disclosure and significant economically for several countries, including Australia and Canada. So it's worthy of investigating further, seeing as there's so much disclosure being generated by these companies. So I titled this slide an enigma. It is a bit of an enigma of AASB 6 as to the IFRS 6. So it's considered a unique industry-specific standard, and there's numerous aspects that are outside of the conceptual framework. It contains special rules for those E&E assets and for the impairment as well. Then also, it's not commonly really understood that there is the difference between AASB and IFRS 6, and that is that stricter test for E&E in AASB 6 versus that IFRS 6. There's also in the accounting profession an awareness, and even there is a website which I thought was somewhat cheekily named as Blind Freddy, which was in a court case where what the justice referred to it as for the mining industry, that maybe companies are kind of just being ignorant and ending up with these accounting errors with the E&E expenditures. And on this video accounting firm website, they even go through each of the common errors that they can see that accounting practitioners are making. So, sorry about that, technology. Okay, so the contribution of the paper. So the paper looks at the literature, it looks to contribute to the literature on the examination of AASB 6, and it uses the three-stage mixed methods approach. The data generated in this paper is very detailed, and it provides a comprehensive picture of the current reporting practices and the concerns of the industry stakeholders. So it adds a contribution for this paper is that standard has been left untouched for a long time, and that it is an industry-specific standard, and that there are comparative differences between IFRS and the AASB standard. So I thought it's a really rich data set. There's qualitative and quantitative information. But the first one, I give a bit of feedback. I'm not sure that the word survey kind of fits with the analysis that you're conducting. Maybe the word descriptive is more appropriate, or just it's more of just, you know, an examination. The second component being that analysis across that 2010 to 2017 period, and in light of that discussion paper being released in 2010. Then there were the interviews with the industry and stakeholders. So moving into my comments. So I would have liked to have in the paper a bit more sort of discussion of like, why are there three stages? Because it is certainly adding a rich data set, but I would have liked to have known a bit more of the motivation for that. What were each of the three stages going to be examining? Then also the second one, did any of the earlier stages, stage one and stage two, then inform the later stages? So were you building on that sequence of knowledge, or were you kind of honing in on these? We now know these are the particular, maybe weaker areas. And so then it influenced maybe what your interview questions were. I would have liked to have seen, you know, was there a learning between each steps? And it's interesting as well, maybe a bit more background about how the financial statements are prepared. So which accounting firms, because we do have industry specialists in mining and extractive industries reporting. And then where are they located versus the company headquarters? So are they co-located in terms of, you know, the headquarters, also the different firms? Because is it the accounting firms who are, there's an indication in the paper of, are they conferring? Are they geographically together? Or are they just in part of a network kind of thing of, hey, what are you doing with this E&E asset? And they're sharing that information. So some minor comments. I really like that in the introduction of the paper, there's the commentary about the environmental, social and governance aspects for these firms, because it's increasingly important, and it's increasingly for finance purposes, we're starting to hear the terminology of climate finance. There's climate consciousness in the financing around the globe. So it was really good to sort of lead into that, motivate the paper with that focus. But then somehow in the middle, stages one and two didn't have any data kind of thing. And then it's only stage three, when you start to do the interviews, do you actually get those issues? So I'm interested to see maybe in that introduction, earlier section of the paper, how does that fit together with the research design? Were you only intending for those issues to come out in the interviews, or was it a surprise in the interviews that they started to mention that? Is it a product of the era now that we're in with our climate consciousness? So the introduction section could benefit from a contributions paragraph. I think if that's clear and kind of standalone, that would help the paper. So I was interested in the stage one in the table that I noticed some of the companies are incorporated in other countries. So is it possible there's some conversions, or that they're reporting under the accounting standards in their own jurisdiction? I would have liked to see a bit of an analysis of the justifications that you list in Appendix 3 in the last column. I thought that's really good data. I would have liked to see a bit more extraction, kind of, you know, maybe a graph or something. So, because I thought that was quite insightful. That's the end of my comments, and all the best with the paper.
Thanks, Victoria. I think Millicent and other authors are ready to answer your questions. But before that, I would like to ask Tom Scott, my fellow board member, to provide his comments. Tom, over to you.
Thanks, Jinqiao. I'm trying to load my presentation, which is, can you see it now?
Yes.
Good.
Very good.
Thank you.
Perfect.
All right. So I'm delighted to be here. And I'm Tom Scott. As Jinqiao said, I'm a member of the International Accounting Standards Board, and I'm pleased to be able to comment on, is AASB6 still fit for purpose? And I just need to, I just need to advance my slide. Okay, there, sorry. so I'm going to divide my comments into three things. The major results of interest to, I think, everyone, but particularly standard setters, doable possible improvements, and other possible extensions. So the major results of interest. The first one, which is important, is that it confirms that there's diversity in practice with respect to capitalizing exploration and evaluation expenditures, that these practices vary across entities, and there's some systematic variance between smaller entities that tend to capitalize more and larger entities that tend to capitalize less. Confirming that diversity is there is valuable to us, as well as documenting that there seems to be a desire among the groups interviewed for better guidance. It would be a useful extension if you could incorporate users' views at some point. There is also evidence that area of interest provides a better unit of account and could be a place to narrow the diversity in practice. Developing area of interest as a unit of account may be both desirable and feasible. With respect to reserves, the paper confirms that the JORC code works well. This is consistent with the view that the IFRS should not intrude into this area. The paper also identifies concerns with IAS 37 and restoration provisions. As well, it notes the possibility that this liability is underreported. The paper identifies that there are distinct transactions and risk-sharing arrangements that are relatively common in extractive industries and present significant challenges to these entities. In this regard, I think an IFRS response to these particular challenges might require a more general assessment of how well financial reporting provides information about risk. So, doable possible improvements. So I use doable in that it may be possible to do these suggestions from the collected sets of financial data and the existing set of interviews. Ideally, the board would like to know the degree to which E&E capitalization is representationally faithful. As well, it would be good to understand the degree to which differences that arise among entities and over time are based on one of three things: different legitimate judgments versus an opportunistic use of the latitude permitted, or simply from inappropriate judgments because a standard lacks clarity. Figures in the paper illustrate only the relative proportion of assets represented by capitalized E&E across the classes. This limits the understanding to the variance between classes of entities, but I don't think it lends itself to fully understand or make inferences about differences in reporting outcomes flowing from the different circumstances versus those that arise from different judgments in applying the standard. Providing additional descriptive stats within a class would help us understand better. Knowing the variance within a class can be helpful because it might provide an additional perspective on whether differences arise due to circumstances versus imprecise accounting standards. Apparently, the within-class variance can be large. For example, the mean proportion of E&E for small cap is 16%, but the paper reports that for some of these entities, it's over 90%. The proportion of assets that is E&E provides only a relatively coarse insight to capitalization of E&E expenditures. For entities that disclose E&E expenditures, I'm not sure how many there might be, it would be useful to examine the degree to which expenditures are capitalized. This would help to focus on the impact that the latitude for choice has on accounting policy. As well, documenting impairment behavior to the degree it can be identified would be interesting and helpful, especially given the ultimate recommendation in the paper. And as a last thing, it might be nice, and I think Victoria hinted at this, that if you could take the interview responses and link them more closely to the empirics that you presented in the earlier stages. With respect to the second major bullet on the slide, could anonymity not be protected while providing the background of the interviewee? Could you identify the interviewees by type of preparer, junior or large, regulator and accountant? Knowing the background of the interviewee would be helpful in understanding the comments and deriving insights from them. So, doable possible improvements too. With respect to defining the area of interest, the paper appears to view variability in the description of an area of interest as a problem. This isn't fully demonstrated in the paper. So given the AASB definition on page 6, could the authors clarify whether the different descriptions represent fundamental differences among the entities across the different groups, or are these essentially semantic? Can some of the responses be used to assess this distinction? And as an extension again, how do users perceive these labels as fundamentally different or semantic? The evidence for using the area of interest to reduce diversity appears to offer a path to make a significant improvement. If we're to do so, it would be useful to know the importance or lack thereof of the labels that are attached to the areas of interest as we go forward. So, other possible extensions. The most obvious is to obtain some user interviews and integrate them into the analysis, where you would presumably pose similar questions to users. As well, per the prior slide, how do users perceive the area of interest labels? The paper reports some inconsistencies and perceptions that would be nice to resolve as well. These are just personal tastes, the ones I picked out. So perhaps questions could be developed to this end. For example, the following quote suggests that the accounting chosen does not matter to a significant degree, but presumably disclosure of E&D expenditure does. The statements I'm going to give are indicative, but not determinative. So one is, Feedback from users to the IASB supported the view that how E&D expenditure is accounted for is not a priority for them. This to me suggests capitalization adds little information. The second one, most Canadian users are of the opinion that expensing all E&E would reduce diversity in practice. Again, I think if they make this suggestion, then they're not overly worried about the information provided by capitalization. However, in the empirical background, it notes a positive association between capitalized E&E expenditures and share prices, and a negative association between E&D expenditures written off and share prices. This suggests, at least in the former case, this suggests that how expenditures are accounted for does add information. So these, at least, I would say, partially conflicting statements suggest an opportunity to use the responses to better understand how the financial information informs investors and how they use it. And there may be other opportunities. So other possible extensions too. Obtaining user views could also be helpful on the possible underreporting of restoration obligations. I think, again, Victoria mentioned this area a little bit, but could this affect perceptions of risk or creditworthiness? Could this translate into risks related to a social license to operate? Could it impact assessments of audit quality? If there is significant underreporting of restoration obligations, then this would represent a significant failure to achieve representationally faithful reporting. Another interesting possibility in the paper, at least I found it interesting, is that the flexibility in IFRS 6 is extended in practice to other reporting areas in the extractive industries. There are a lot of interesting things in the papers. You're just getting one that particularly appealed to me. But one observation in the paper is that the limited guidance in IFRS 6 affords reporting entities significant flexibility, not just for E&E, but even on other things such as revenue recognition. Gray et al., the paper by Gray and some colleagues, makes a related comment that the flexibility afforded to E&E under IFRS may lead to a perception that flexibility extends to other IFRS standards. An evaluation of whether the responses from the interviewees can provide any further light on this issue, I think, would be quite interesting. Essentially, I think there are at least two non-mutually exclusive factors that could lead to diversity in financial reporting in the extractive industries. The paper makes the point, and the comments also cover this, is that there is a wide diversity of arrangements that exist within the industry for which the application of other IFRS standards can be challenging or may not provide a representationally faithful result. But then we also have this issue of a possible contagion, is that the general latitude for E&E can extend perhaps into the way the accounting is done for under other standards. Is that once you've sort of got this sense of it doesn't matter that much how I do it, do I actually carry this mentality forward? And I just thought that was a really neat thing. And also because Gray et al. Also kind of raised this point, that might be something to pursue. It's not something that I've seen very often in academic papers, that this issue, but it's something that you might be placed to investigate. So in just summarizing these, so with respect to these two possibilities, do both sources of diversity exist? Is there a contagion effect? Are these sources of diversity factors are these sources of diversity possible factors that could contribute to the weak link between extractive industries' earnings and prices or returns that have been observed in some studies? If both sources of diversity exist, then what possible solutions might there be to each? So this concludes my remarks, and I wish to thank the authors again for an interesting and informative paper. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom, for your comprehensive, thoughtful comments. And obviously, I think Victoria and Tom both made excellent comments to the paper, and very interesting. And I feel very helpful from my perspective. So now I give the floor to Millicent or Karini or other authors. Would you like to respond to the to some of the comments or points made by Victoria and Tom?
Karini, you want to go first?
Sure. Thank you so much for the opportunity, and apologies for coming in late. I had a child getting to bed matter earlier, so my apologies for coming in late to the meeting. Thank you so much, Victoria and Tom, for your insightful comments, and thank you, Millie, for presenting our work so beautifully. There is so much in those two responses to our comments. I'm not quite sure where to start, except to say I need a couple of PhD students and a few more papers to write so we can complete all that work. There's some really important points raised there. The semantics point that Tom raised is a really important one, I think, particularly when it comes to trying to define what is an area of interest and how, whether it's a geological area or a particular geographic area, a rights to tenure, what those types of issues are that companies choose to call their particular area of interest. And that's something that we grappled with a lot, how to break that down. And, when we were looking at the annual reports and trying to deal with respondents' comments. So that was something that I really wanted to thank you for that comment, Tom, because that's something that we had trouble with as well. The matter of IAS 37 and how we address that as a matter of rehabilitation and those matters being underreported, I would love to get into that project. I think that's something I had thought about as my PhD area, which I didn't take up. I ended up having the PhD be on IFRS 6, and so that ended up being this is my thing, but IAS 37 and the underreporting of rehabilitation costs in the mining sector was something that I think is a fascinating project, and something that I think we could take up as, it's much more of an issue now than it was 15 years ago when I started to look into these things. And the mixed views that come about as a result of what the literature says in terms of E&Es having an impact on results in the market versus what companies and preparers say the E&E impacts have is conflicting. So I think that's really a difficult thing to answer, and it would be great if we could get some users to talk to us. We tried and tried and tried to get people to talk to us. It went on for like 12 months, didn't it, Millie, trying to get people to interview with us, and we ended up having to report to the IAS, to the AASB, and we just had to call the ball and write up our responses. So Millie, do you have anything that you want to add?
Yes, thanks, Corinne. I really like the idea about looking at the flexibility contagion effect on other standards. And I'm thinking we can do a comparison of, Australian companies with other companies who are applying the IFRS 6 and to look at that effect. So I think there's a real study there that we could use to extend on this current study, and I'm thinking a lot about what you said about looking at the durable improvements, looking at the capitalization and the conversion of the expenditure to assets, that capitalization aspect, and trying to explain the differences in company differences. Besides, we've only looked at size differences here. There could be other reasons for changes in the capitalization of the E&E expenditure. So thank you for those comments.
Thanks, Milia. And Corinne, do you have additional comment, response?
I'm just looking at the note that Victoria's put up in the chat does the lack of guidance from the standard allow for aggressive accounting? I think it absolutely does. I mean, the option to be able to capitalise E&E costs is very attractive, I think, to preparers of financial reports. And it's an historical problem that's been going on for decades. You know, the fact that the junior companies can choose to capitalise 90% of their E&E costs to make their balance sheets look beautiful and avoid taking those costs to their P&Ls is a very aggressive way of accounting, I think. And so, you know, whether that's a matter of survival or whether it's a matter of being incredibly aggressive, you know, is a judgment call, isn't it? But, you know, I think that the idea behind whether or not we want to create a set of standards that improves comparability for users in the marketplace is something that we need to think about. And it's not just users for that are shareholders, it's users that are broader stakeholders in the community. And that's what I think ultimately that the ISB tries to do. And that's something that we need to think about. That's what motivates me to keep doing this work.
Okay, thank you. For participants, if you have any questions, you can post your question.
I think Anne has a question.
Chat room. And also, maybe you just simply raise your hands, use the raise your hands button. I see there is one hand raising up. And do you want to ask question first? And then I will go to.
Thanks. Thanks, Jen Chow. Thanks, Corinne and Millie, for this very interesting paper. Corinne, I just want to come back on your comment about aggressive accounting following Victoria's comment. So your comment was, yes, obviously companies can be aggressive. So my question to you is, though, is it not glaringly apparent what they're doing? So the capitalized versus expense decision, it's reported, analysts can see it. So do you really think the issue is there, or is it in other areas where they don't make things so clear? So in some of your tables, you indicate that companies, that you couldn't work out what the accounting policy was, or it wasn't named, or it wasn't clear. And I don't know if that's intentional, i.e. aggressive or obscuring things, or just very slack reporting. But so my question is, you know, it's okay for you to say capitalization aggressive, but capitalization is very transparent. So in your work, do you think there are other areas that are not transparent where companies are trying to be aggressive, if you will, or hiding things?
Yeah.
Did you observe other areas? And if so, you know, where do you think those areas of lack of transparency are?
Okay, yeah, that's a really good point. Perhaps I use aggressive when I shouldn't, when transparency is not necessary, they're still transparent. So aggressive perhaps is not the right word there then, because they're not actually hiding anything, are they? It's still very transparent. Millie, you look like you want to say something.
But I think that's a good point, because it's a good point because we could look at other reasons for the reporting in a certain way and the capitalization. I think this comes back to Tom's point about explaining the capitalization process, looking into other factors besides it's difficult to look at the judgments made, but if we could look at other factors within the firm, and then maybe extend it beyond the to get an insight into the decisions that were made in the capitalization process.
Thank you.
Thanks. I think Hafiz do have questions to ask Hafiz.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much, Corinne. Thank you for this amazing study. We are doing something quite similar. I should not disclose this here, As you said, aggressive accounting or whatever we name it, it comes from different aspects, and we know the problem. I'm just coming back to what Anne said. The problem with disclosures, we found similar to what you found. Many companies do not disclose the accounting method they use, and they mix accounting treatment, so you don't find a pure full cost method or pure successful effort method at the moment. So there is a problem with inter and intra method comparability, and this is because of the accounting choices. Now, the IFRS 6 is focusing on E&E, but what we found also in our study, the pre-licensing cost initially should be expensed. But we found some companies capitalizing them. So I have a question to you. I'm not sure if you touched on this area, on the pre-licensing cost. So do you think this is an area of concern as well for any future accounting standard that tackle the issue around extractive industries? So do we want the new IFRSX to extend to include the pre-licensing cost as well? Thank you.
Thank you for that question, Hafez. It's nice to see you here. The pre-licensing costs, I mean, I think that depends on, again, how that's defined. For my understanding of IFRS 6 is that it focuses on the upstream activities, which include the pre-production activities. Pre-licensing are those costs and activities that occur before the rights to tenure or before the lease has been secured on a particular area. Here I'm going area of interest again. So those pre-licensing activities, I believe, are not included as part of the costs of exploration and evaluation activities. So that would be outside the scope of IFRS 6, is my understanding, yeah, and my read of the standard.
Thank you.
Whether or not they should be, I don't know. That's your paper, not mine. Yeah.
No, I fully understand. On the same note, I talked to a number of petroleum engineers, and they, as you said, they explained this pre-licensing cost, especially the prospecting. Many companies consider these prospecting costs or studies are part of exploration if the exploration resulted in successful discoveries.
I think it depends on whether there's a license purchase to explore within a particular area. If there's not a license purchase to explore in a particular area, then the costs cannot be included in that particular in that particular cost center. I think it depends on whether or not there's a license to explore. If there's not, then that's a pre-prospecting. That's what makes it a pre-prospecting or pre-licensing cost. Once the license is purchased or the prospect area is purchased, then those costs can be included. Otherwise, they need to be, you know, it's like a pre-exploration expense that can't be included. That's my understanding.
Thank you.
Thank you. I didn't see any hands up or questions posed in the chat room. So if so, I think we can conclude this session. Thank you, Milie and Corianne, for your presentation and excellent paper. It really has direct link to our ISB's project. Thank you so much. I would also like to thank Tom and Victoria for your excellent constructive, you know, comments made, very useful, very helpful. Thank you again. So now let's have, I think we are ahead of time schedule. Let's have 5 minutes or 6 minutes break, and let's reconvene at. And
Jen Chow, can we reconvene at the scheduled time, which would be 10:05 UK time?